Hailed by NPR as a literary badass and a master storyteller with a rock and roll heart, Luis Alberto Urrea is a prolific and acclaimed writer who uses his dual culture and life experiences to explore the themes of love, loss, and triumph. A 2005 Pulitzer Prize finalist for nonfiction, Urrea is the critically acclaimed and best-selling author of over 16 books. Born in Tijuana to a Mexican father and American mother, Urrea is most recognized as a border writer. His books have won awards too many to mention here, and they have been adapted by universities across the country, and over 100 cities and colleges have chosen his books as their one community read. Urrea lives with his family in Illinois, where he's a distinguished professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois Chicago. Luis Alberto Urrea, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you and an honor to have you.
My brother.
Been really busy out there, pounding the pavement and, traversing the universe. So thank you for taking time.
Dude, every time I go to one of these things, I think, okay, this is a hotel that my dad or I would have been really happy to clean the bathrooms. And the colonists are putting me in a penthouse. So, okay, that's good.
Oh, speaking of hotels, we're talking about your wonderful new book called Wandering Time. And there's this image that I really love where they put you into this really nice hotel in San Diego. You're doing a reading there. And you look out and you realize you're looking at Tijuana, where you were born or where you lived.
Yeah.
That must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, that was that's so cool that they reissued that book. It's actually...
Yes.
Old, but now it's out in kind of sexy new package.
yeah, that's
that made
right.
Me happy, but yeah, man, it was early in the career, and I was, they asked me to come back to San Diego to read, and they put me in the top floor of this Harbor Tower thing, and I was standing there in the window, and I was realizing I was looking at Tijuana, and I could see our hill, mm-hmm. Colonia Independencia is by the TV towers on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was looking off to the side, and there was Logan, man, And I thought, that's my entire past.
Wow.
And I'm up here now.
Did you wave to yourself?
Yeah, did I wave to myself?
That's right.
If I could have traveled back in time, I don't think that, little Luis would have believed me.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's so. But I think so many of us have that experience. And, it's just so vitally important that we don't forget that there are thousands of us, and they're suffering like we didn't suffer, man. They're being told every day that they're no good and they're rapists and murderers, and our kids are heartbroken. So I just try as much as I possibly can to go talk to them and just visit with them. And sometimes they don't even want to talk. Sometimes they just want a hug. It's so funny, man.
Right. Luis, you mentioned little Luis on the other side of there in Tijuana.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to ask you, just out of my own curiosity, how did young Luis come across, or how did writing, poetry or just writing in general find you?
Oh, man, I always kid with the youngins when I go to these schools and stuff, because I tell them, I know what you're asking yourselves. You're saying, how come this vato looks white? So coming up, especially when we came to the U.S., I came because I had tuberculosis, and they had to get me out of the barrio in Tijuana. And so we first settled in National City, which is down south, and then Logan. And there I was, sort of Irish-looking Mexican kid with a strong Tijuana accent. Right. And, it was in the middle of crazy race war, right? Brown versus black versus white in any combination. And then I come walking down the street looking Irish and talking about Tijuana. So one of the things I joke about on stage when I'm talking is I was like a one-man civil rights movement, because the group said, let us kick his ass today. So I would stay inside our apartment a lot and read.
Right.
And, I think I've been really pondering this, and I realized that at the end of fourth grade, we left the barrio and moved up to essentially middle-class white working suburb.
Right.
We were the first, quote, mixed family, whatever.
Right.
And I found out all of a sudden, out of the blue, from my new little Boy Scout white boyfriends, that I was, quote, a greaser wetback.
Mm.
I was like, what's that?
Right.
What is that? And all of a sudden, all the people that were sacred to me, that were holy and magical and full of stories and myths and legends and el cucuy and all that stuff, all my abuelita, my tías, my primos, were suddenly scum and were suddenly no good. And Tijuana was suddenly filthy. And it was such a shock that the most sacred people I knew were suddenly some kind of underclass subhuman because we moved 20 miles. I was like, what?
Right.
And so at the time that music and you know, songwriters and poets were all invading my brain, I also was feeling this total heartbreak about people that I loved. And I think the compulsion to write just started firing off in me. And partially was I wanted to represent them. I didn't think guys like you and me would ever publish books. I didn't know we could.
Right.
But I couldn't stop myself.
There's a certain amount of perhaps alienation or even just solitude to writers and to artists, and they kind of need that time alone. And
and
I'm wondering if that experience caused you to move into yourself and to spend a lot of time with yourself, and if that caused you to think of stories and think of expressing yourself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And my family was a very unhappy family, and my parents slept apart, and both of them were racked with horrors from their past, and they yelled and cried out in their sleep, and my father ground his teeth till they all broke. So, you know, I was insomniac, man, because I couldn't sleep, and it was like a house of, it was como un manicomio, you know? And so I'd be up at midnight, me and Leonard Cohen, you know, me and Jim Morrison or whatever, and writing my stuff and feeling like I was alone in the universe.
Wow.
It was very, and we were, you know, struggling for money. So I felt really alone. And I think, and reading Charles Bukowski or Richard Brodigan, you know,
I
thought I had all these pals, these imaginary friends.
Right.
And the isolation part is very interesting because by the time I got into, I think, the middle of high school, my writing suddenly became a communication tool. I didn't realize that we didn't just write to ourselves and to God or the devil, but there were other people that actually saw my stuff and started responding to it.
Right.
And I cannot minimize the effect of girls on a lonesome boy. You know what I mean? I thought, wait a minute, they like poems?
Yeah.
Orale! Watch me now! You know? But that turned into homework. I didn't know that, you know, you were actually working on your craft. And then when I got to college, this miracle happened. I'm sure you guys have a similar experience to this, that growing up, there was no such thing as a Latino, Chicano, Mexicano author.
Right. I didn't even hear about Gary Soto until I was at the university.
Yeah, me too. The first book I read that was like that. Yeah, that
dude, exactly. Was, you know what we had? The teachers would talk about this book called Don Quixote. And I thought it was a book about a donkey.
That sounds like Jose Montoya calling Dostoevsky a cowboy, Dusty Vesky.
Dusty Vesky.
The Russian cowboy.
I heard that. I was like, and then I get to college, right? And they were like, so we're going to read Borges. And I thought, Borges who? And Cortázar, Neruda, and here comes Carlos Fuentes. And that was all cool and mind-boggling until I found Alurista.
Right. Interesting.
And I said, wait a minute, este vato, what?
Right.
You know, and he's got these roots in Tijuana and San Diego.
Right.
And what is he doing? And I, and he was a grad student at my college, so I met Alurista. And suddenly I realized to my undying shock that there were these brilliant Chicano men and women all around me that I did not know were writing work and publishing work and doing all this social stuff. And it was transformative. So, you know, I felt like isolation, and then sort of growth, and then integration.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it worked, you know, and it took until college.
In your book, you write that for a writer, it's important to be quiet and in love with park benches. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's just... My wife always tells me that I have a Jesus complex, you know? and I
not a
tell
Jesus
myself
complex.
That I have a really spiritual response, but I think it's erotic, man. I think I am constantly flirting with everything. I'm in love with stuff. If I let myself, I want to hug everything, man. I want to touch everything, and so I think being in love with park benches, I meant, you know, just. We're given this world, and it's here, and we're passing so fast that, you know, cada piedrita, we should touch it and hold it and realize, you know. I understand later, after years of reading, I really became enamored of Asian poets and particularly Japanese poets, and I started to understand, you know, that I was having kind of a Zen haiku relationship to the world without knowing it. You know, we are all passing. We're all mortal, even the rocks. And, you know, so I think I was raised with so much dread and so much regret and kind of imposed self-loathing that I just want to feel, for whatever time I've got left, as much love as I possibly can.
Right. And, you know, certainly if you weren't Zen before, after living in Boulder, Colorado a few years, it becomes Zen.
I knew you were
going to
bring up Colorado, man.
I know. Hey, listen, there's so much I want to say about this book, Luis, you know, but, you know, to try and describe it to the readers out there, to the listeners out there, you know, it's a torrent. It's also a gentle river. It's fluid, you know, and it's like at the end of the reading the book, I was feeling like, you know, I felt like I just went on a long cross-country road trip with Luis, you know, which is a great feeling because, you know, we're listening to music and there's like, you know, obviously you're talking about Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison and then we're, you know, philosophizing and then we're talking about the stars and then we're talking about hugging trees and cottonwoods and it's just like, it's like a long road trip, man. It's a great, you know, one of the things though that came to my mind is that I know that Matsuo Basho has influenced some of your work as well, and obviously he's got a hand in this collection as well. And there is a poem that Basho wrote that influenced me years ago when I was actually a student there at Naropa in Boulder. And in the poem, he says, "If you want to learn of the bamboo, you must go to the bamboo."
Yeah.
And, you know, I realize, especially because I know that this book, Wandering Time, came early on in your career, you have pretty much applied that approach to almost every book you've ever written, you know, going into the physical space of your subject or of the matter. And especially like in this kind of day and age where, you know, everything's at our fingertips in a search engine, right? You know, why is it so vital that not only as writers, but as humans, right, we go to the bamboo, we go to the place, we go to the spaces?
You have to, you know... We live in an unexperiential world now, man. We participate by a remove. Mm-hmm. We multitask. If you came into my house to watch my kids watch TV, all of them are on their screen thinking they're watching TV. Do you know what I mean?
TV
is already removed from the world.
That's right.
And Onitsura, one of my other favorite haiku poet, says, "To know the plum, you must know your heart and also your nose."
Yeah.
I thought, yeah,
wow.
Man.
That's right.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a little thing. I mean, well, two things. When I was working on Hummingbird's Daughter, right, it took me 20 years to write that book. Mm. And part of the reason it took so long was to have to go study with curanderas and medicine people and experience the world their way.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the messages, which I just haunts me to this day, was everything is made of light. Things are just solid light, but it's all light.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, wow, wait a minute. Yeah. You know. And the other thing is that Wandering Time book happened while I was in Tucson. I had left Boulder and gone to Tucson to be near the Yaqui people so I could learn more to write the book. And all hell broke loose. It was cataclysmic. And my life kind of ground to a halt. My career had stopped. I lost this person I thought I was going to marry, you know, fall in love with a woman from Mexico City. It's over for you right there. But entonces, you know, I had fallings out with my family, and I was out of money. I mean, just everything crashed to a halt, which I understood later was part of the spiritual process. I had said essentially to the universe, yeah, I'm going to go on this spiritual quest. And the universe said, okay, well, let's take away all the distractions then.
Right.
And then I was like, well, I wasn't that serious. You know, you can you can bring food back. That'd be good. So I hit bottom hard. And I was so racked with so much torment that I couldn't read anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could read, all I could manage to process were haiku. I was like, okay, 17 syllables, I can do that.
I can keep my attention.
Yeah, but it started to penetrate because I started realizing that, you know, Isa or someone like that was not that far removed in his soul from Netzahualcoyot.
Right,
know?
Right.
And so I was going through that, and I had met Cindy, and I thought, honest to God, I thought I was going to die. I thought I was at the end of my life at that point. You know, it's comedic now in a way because all I had really was hundreds of boxes of my unsold first novel. I had spent my entire bank account to buy them so they wouldn't be remaindered. So I'd made my bed out of boxes of my unwanted book, right? I slept on my failure every night.
Wow.
It was terrible. And and I thought I was going to pass away. So I wrote Wandering Time as a gift to her. As like my testament of what my soul was.
Yeah.
And I based it on haiku books, so that's why, you know, it's seasonal.
Right.
And because I was so depressed, I put two springs in it. It starts and ends in springtime.
Right.
And I gave it to her. And then later, I helped U of A with the Caminos del Sol series, and I was one of the early books in it.
Mm.
And that was Nobody's Son.
Right.
And the editor, I let her read this, because it turned out I had lived, and she wanted to publish it. So I made this deal with them, and only a university press would do this. But I said, okay, I want this book to be totally non-commercial. I want you to never promote it. And they were like, what? I said, never push it, never market it, and I want it to look like a haiku book and be cheap. And they were like, this is interesting. But I, you know, the whole point of the book was that it had to be one that you accidentally found.
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I mean? Like finding a rock on a trail.
And that's exactly how I felt, too, because after learning that, you know, this book had been published so long ago, it was like, where has this book been all my life, you know?
But it's been hiding,
that's
dude.
Right. And, you know, that's right. And, you know, that's why now, finding it now, though, you know, after even having read your other books that came after this book, you know, it has so much more, I think, gravity and just weight to it.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
In many ways, this book, every writer should read it. I think you can learn a lot about the writing process.
Thanks.
But one of the things you say is that writers, or those who want to be writers, would learn more from the great writers reading their journals than they would from reading their Pulitzer Prize winning novels.
Yeah, I think so, because they're rawer, they're more immediate, you know, they're less, I think they're less processed.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, and for me, you know, I was always a John Cheever fan.
Right.
I liked his work, but when his journals came out, I was blown out of my seat.
Right.
I thought, oh my God, this is actually a full person with all these terrible foibles, but these yearnings and these eruptions, you know, the duende was highly evident.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Right. That's a good point.
And so, yeah, I find those things really fantastic. In fact, you gentlemen should consider this and go in on it with me. I thought it would be really brilliant to start a journal that was exclusively of things like journals.
That's a great idea. Yeah,
that is a great idea.
That is.
What are the ways, man? Like the Chicano Journal, you know, a scholarly publication.
The Journal of a Journal?
The Journal of Journals,
All right, we're doing it.
As a writer, reading this just really inspired me. In fact, right after I read, I was halfway through it, I said, I got to put this down and go take a walk.
Oh, my God. That's so cool.
Right. And you have this equation, which I completely agree with, where it's walking equals writing.
Yeah, right?
And then there's this other quote that really struck me because I think it's connected. Well, one is that you say dare to be naive.
Yeah.
And then
yes.
in another one, you say it's easy to be miserable, hard to live in joy.
Yes, sir. Yes. Take some discipline to remind yourself about joy.
Yeah, yeah. Can you explain that a little bit? And also maybe talk a little bit about these ideas, how they're rooted in actually just being, not thinking, not, you know, being in the future or being in the past, but just being.
Yeah, it's my worst struggle, man. Yeah. Just being here, you know, be here now, as they say. You don't want to live in the past. And if you live in the future, to me, it's worry.
Yeah,
so,
right.
you know, doubt is regret, except for some really juicy memories about, you know, making out. But and the future is worry. And I miss the day.
Yeah.
I miss this day. And so, yeah, it was very much about trying to show myself or remind myself to open my eyes and to see. And it's important to me because my eyes are not very good. And so seeing, especially as I get older, is clearly becoming more and more of a precious commodity. And you think, wow, one day, what if my eyes totally fail? I want to be here and I want to suck it up. And Timoteo will recognize this, but when I moved to Boulder, you know, mm-hmm. I'd always loved the outdoors and I'd always walked around and done hikes and stuff, but something about the Rockies.
Yeah, yeah.
Something about the Front Range, especially, and this is so simple and almost silly, but the Boulder Creek path.
Yeah.
I was unhappy. Things were a little rough in my personal life at that time. I mean, that's, the, you know, the times that are curses to you are sometimes sort of inspirations to go to transcendence, and you don't know it. And so every day I would start walking up the path, and I'd go farther and farther until, you know, every day it was my practice to go all the way up to the very end of the path and then stroll back down. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go up partway and then go up that sideways to the red, you know, the red rocks that looked like a battlement, and then run down and then go back, you know.
Yeah.
And as I did that as a daily practice, that's when walking became writing, because I would carry my notebook. And I remember something so simple, but I was sitting by that Lover's Leap rock on the creek, and I was under an apple tree. And for me, barrio boy, to be picking wild apples as I walked to eat, are you kidding? I couldn't believe it, man. And I was sitting there, and I was looking at my page, and the shadows of the leaves were moving around on my page, and I was like, holy God, I'm reading what the apple tree says. You know, I felt like Han Shan or something, you know, in China, being all cosmic. But it was so simple and so beautiful. And the other thing I would say about this is, even back then, I was trying to do Hummingbird's Daughter, and I was getting help from Vine Deloria Jr. And he was always, you know, pushing me around and advising me. And you know, he told me, if you really want to know this part of these mountains, you better learn Arapaho, man. He said the mountains are lonesome. It's not just you. They're lonesome because they don't hear their language anymore.
Yeah.
That moved me, man.
Absolutely.
That was just beautiful.
And, you know, you just kind of further along on that same thought, you know, early in the book, you also write, you know, that it seems that to be a good writer, you must excel in two things, which is, one is poking around, you know, the curiosity, and then the other is paying attention. And obviously you're explaining there how you were paying attention that day with the apple leaves, you know, and, you know, and then also I think you later on, probably in that same page, you talk about, you mentioned Donald Hall's quote, "The body is poetry's door."
Yes.
And, you know, like most people, I myself was born, we're all kind of born with that, you know, inherent curiosity that kind of, that never leaves us. But the possibility of paying attention, I think it starts to leave us, you know, almost instantly, or it starts to get beaten out of us, right? Paying attention.
It does get beaten out of us, and you're rewarded for not paying attention.
That's right, exactly. Right. On the other end of that, you're rewarded for not paying attention, absolutely. So I guess my question was, you know, other than, is it walking that is sort of becomes a kind of a mindfulness practice for you, or, you know, I mean, or is it, do you meditate? I mean, what is it that you do to cultivate that kind of paying attention, or the eye on paying attention?
You know, honestly, I think it's just greed. I'm greedy. I want it all. I want everything I can get out of the world. And I'm lucky, I think, in that my interests are kind of simple.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, some of my favorite writing in the world unfortunately, is when I'm speeding down the highway and I'm like, okay, I can't write because I'm going to kill everybody. But fortunately, my wife has control issues, so she likes to drive. And I often am just sitting there watching the world go by, and you can't write fast enough to capture everything you see, so you have to jot fast notes, which in their own right become a kind of instant poetry. And something starts to happen between, I think, the being in the day, the observing the day, the speeding through space, and the absorbing and processing quickly through your body, so that it feels like the road or the river or whatever it is you're in enters you and flows through you, and you can feel it. And that happens to me on stage, too. You know, lately, and it was just merely an accident because my eyes were, I'm so nearsighted that I was having trouble reading a text, and I chucked the book and did the text from memory. I was like, yeah, screw this, I'm done. And it turned into some big showstopper, right? And unfortunately for me, everywhere I go, people some often announce, he's now going to do an incredible act. I think, oh, dang, I was just going to read something. But you know, it's that too, that you realize, Kim Stafford says, as a writer, I'm not so much a creator as a receiver. Mm-hmm. And I think there is this flow, man. There's this, it's the Holy Spirit, my brothers.
Absolutely.
But, you know, there's this power that wants to come. And so if I have any process, and I wish I had the discipline to be a meditator, I think it probably would be an incredible thing for me. But if there's any process involved, it's the process of trying to humble myself before this torrent that we all get. We are blessed to get to tap into that torrent.
Right.
You know, like Ana Castillo, you see her grab it and whoosh, when it hits, it hits. You know, Ben does it too. So when I get on stage, for example, or when I sit down to write, I try to avail myself of that torrent, that thing that flows through the world wanting to express itself, and I try to let it do it. William Stafford said, if you breathe, you're in the rhythm business, to help people write poems,
That's
you know,
great.
And I
That's
thought,
it.
Yeah, man.
And you also have this quote where you say, nobody who is not an artist can be a Christian.
Yeah, that was, I think that was Blake who said that, somebody. And people got mad at me, and they're like, hey, you can't say only Christians are artists. I say, no, I said just the opposite, actually.
Right, and Blake says all religions are the same, so I think we know what he means.
You know, the point is that it's our job to take part in the act of creation.
Right.
And the God is out there convince people that they're being creative when they're destructive.
Mm.
And when we're talking about paying attention, or as we Mexicans brilliantly say, lending attention, which I think has been better. Presta atención.
Yes.
It's a lot more humble. You know, Trump's candidacy is entirely a guy telling everybody, hey, just don't pay attention to what's right before your nose.
Right. Mm. That's right.
Be miserable. The more miserable and angry you are, the better it is for me. He's having a great time. So I think a lot of the world is that way. Don't close yourself up. Let it splash off your head. Don't let it flow through you. And if it does flow through you, you're kind of liberated, and that makes you dangerous.
You have a question that I want to ask you.
Yeah.
The question that you raise in the book is, it's a really beautiful question. You say our bodies are two-thirds water, and then you ask people, what body of water makes you up? And I was thinking my answer would probably be all the toilets my parents used before I was born. But what body of water makes you?
Ay, 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 man.
Good question, yeah.
You know, we didn't have a whole lot of water in Tijuana.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a whole lot of water in San Diego either. So I don't know. You know, I think, honestly, it's got to be the Colorado and the tributaries.
Yeah.
I think I came into my own up there on Boulder Creek.
Yeah.
So in 82, I'd been working in, you know, Tijuana and all that stuff with the garbage pickers, and then I got hired to teach writing at Harvard, and I don't know how that happened. And I don't know how I survived it, because it was overwhelming, but that was my first real experience of water, is being out there, Walden Pond, you know, the Charles River.
Right.
So I would say that, I mean, it sounds so precious to say, well, you know, Walden Pond.
Yeah, no. I know. I was blown away when I learned they had a Walden Pond there in Boulder also.
Yeah, right. The Walden,
Walden
Pond out in Boulder.
Well, we have been speaking with the award-winning author Luis Alberto Urrea about his book Wandering Time. But, of course, we're fans of all of his wonderful books, The Hummingbird's Daughter, The Devil's Highway, Into the Beautiful North. But I urge you to go out and pick up Wandering Time. Luis, we're fans of your work. You know, what else can we say here? We're big fans. So, you know, we're really honored to have you on the show.
We're all fans of each other, man.
Yeah.
You got to look out for each other.
Right on.
Yeah, absolutely.